Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. This is Dan Rettina, founder of Dan's Papers, and my guest for this podcast is Minerva Perez. She's the executive director of OLA, which I will now ask you to describe the mission of OLA, which has been around for quite some time.
Thank you, Dan. I'm really happy to be here. OLA's been around since 2002, so now we're going into almost 24 years. Our mission is to create a more equitable, a safer, and a healthier East End for everyone. And we certainly do have a focus on immigrants and Latino immigrants, both from many, many years ago and decades ago and generations ago, and also recent. But a lot of our work impacts and betters the lives of many people out here that are not Latino at all. And so I can share some of those things too, if you like.
I guess the big elephant in the room is men with masks arresting people and taking them to some place to be held and then shipped back to a strange country. That's what's going on right now.
Yeah, and I think the way that we see it with OLA is as one East End community, which we are. Our school districts, we have about 22 school districts, and a low number is 50% Latino student body for years and years. So I don't consider these separate communities. We are one community. So men with masks taking some of our community members, oftentimes without any criminal backgrounds, and frightening children so that they don't go to school, frightening parents so they don't take their kids to necessary doctor's appointments. These are things that impact all of us as a community. And so it's concerning for everyone, which is why the law that we wrote is a public safety law, not an anti-immigration law, not an anti-ICE law. It is simply a public safety law to make sure that on a local level, 10 municipalities, which is a lot, but you know, we love it, 10 municipalities that have their own law enforcement agencies have a plan in place and an agreement in place so that the community members understand where that safety is, what can be done. Certainly we know what can't be done at this point, but we know that our local law enforcement and our local towns and villages have great care for our public safety and law and order and sort of a peaceful way to move about the streets, get your kids to and from school, go to the doctors. So we want to make sure that that is preserved, even when this agency of ICE comes out and oftentimes does their business in a reckless fashion. We want to make sure that at a very basic level, our public safety is maintained out here. So that's why we wrote the law. Fred Thiel wrote the law. He's on the OLA board. So yeah, we're excited about that.
Did all of the towns sign on for this? And if so, how far west?
East End of Long Island is what the area that we serve as a nonprofit. And so that includes all five East End towns and the villages and hamlets. So that's up to Riverhead and Southold, Southampton, Shelter Island, East Hampton, and then all the villages within. So that's 10 municipalities that have their own law enforcement agencies. And those law enforcement agencies do not report to Suffolk County. They're very independent, which we think is great. But so it covers that whole area. And right now at this moment, this is a process, you know, so we're not waving a wand and saying, adopt OLA's law. We're saying, hey, we did the heavy lifting for you. Let's do something that is meaningful and not a nice sounding statement, but a meaningful law that has accountability attached to it. So right now, East Hampton Village was the first municipality to fully vote forward, and they have this law now. East Hampton Town is coming up soon. And then after that, we are in constant talks with Southold. We're beginning really important talks with Riverhead, finally, with Southampton, Sag Harbor Village, West Hampton Village, East Quogue, Shelter Island, all of these areas. You know, we need all of them to be on board with this law.
How does it work in reality? And what can you do and what can't you do if you're endangered in some way?
I'll talk about the law that we proposed, which again is not an anti-ICE law. What it does is very clear the powers that the federal government have, the fact that as a local law enforcement agency or local government. You can't stop ICE from doing one of their actions. So we establish all of that. And then we say that if ICE is showing up on the scene, that law enforcement could be 911, it could be somebody else calling and saying, we think ICE is, convening in a particular location. And then law enforcement will go out, assess the situation, and report back either to the supervisor or the mayor. And then at that point, there will be an emergency plan in place in the event that ICE is at a sensitive location, like in front of a school or at an emergency room or a cancer center or something like that. Because in those places, there needs to be a higher level of safety and order so that people don't get hurt. Anybody, not just Latinos, anybody that might be going to and from a hospital, to and from a school. So we want to make sure that in those moments, there's a safety plan that's put together by that particular town or village that we're not going to create, that they create to make sure that that's in place. So this law basically says police respond, they report back. They're not going to stop ICE, but they're going to be there to establish the fact that, yeah, that is actually an ICE action, so that that goes on the record. They are going to be there to make sure that students can feel safer going from the school building to the school bus if they're on their way home, or if they're getting off the bus to go into the school building and ICE happens to be right out front. We need to establish that the presence of ICE when they do their activities that can be extremely hectic and dangerous is that there is a sense of order around our children, our elders, our sick. So that's what this law basically establishes. So we could put that aside. It's a very simple thing. It's almost like a non-issue, except for it is an issue when nobody wants to vote it forward without months and months of conversations. It's kind of ridiculous, but we are giving it its due time and we're going to keep doing it. That's the law. Separate from that, if you're asking in general, what can people do? What's the exact question, Dan? I just want to get it right.
You were talking to someone who might be concerned that ICE would be seeing them. What actions or things can they do that would come under safety, public safety?
As an individual, I don't control public safety. As a town or a village, I control public safety. So, as an individual, if I'm taking my kid to school and I look like me right now, which, I am half Puerto Rican, but, some people look a different way. There's a lot to do with looks. I mean, there are a couple of lawsuits that are out right now that are showing and alleging that these activities that are profiling based are simply, you look a certain way, I'm going to now approach you, talk to you, and make some assumptions about you, even when I have nothing about your background and you have no criminal background, but I'm going to take you because you look a certain way and you speak Spanish. There are lawsuits right now that are pushing back against that kind of profiling, the basis of that being profiling. So the fear that I might have if I look a certain way, taking my child to school, even if I'm fully documented, do I want to get caught up in some mistaken identity thing when I'm with my child? Of course not. So, what does that mean for me? Will I avoid taking my child to school that day if I learn that ICE is right in front of the building and I usually walk my kid to school? Maybe I will not do that that day. Maybe I won't put my kid on the bus that day, not because they're not documented, but because they're going to have to see horrible sights in front of their school. So, and whether I'm a full white person with 17 generations in Southampton, do I want my child to experience that in front of their elementary school? Not really. So, this concern is everyone's concern. There are ways to answer that question based on identity, based on perceived identity. But ultimately, is that how we want to be living right now? Because here's the thing, every Latino that I talk to would love for the convicted violent felon and criminal to be taken away with due process, justice, but I don't want them next to me, if they have been convicted of a crime and somehow they're escaping. The reality is that that's not what's happening with these immigration enforcement actions. They are trying to scoop up as many people as they can. And then when we say, hey, but they had no criminal background, their answer is, but they're criminals because they're in this country unlawfully. The reality is that many of those people are in the middle of lawful processes, meaning that they have a viable asylum pathway that they've been on forever because our immigration process takes a long time. So they may be involved in this asylum process for 5 years or more or whatever it might be. And it's a lawful process. So according to our own laws, they are lawfully allowed to be in this country, not having a green card yet or a citizenship. piece of paper yet, but they are lawfully part of a process. But ICE at this moment is relegating anyone that either doesn't have a green card or citizenship as someone who is unlawfully in this country and therefore a criminal. The way we use language is extremely important right now. So everyone has a reason to have a level of fear. And that's the unfortunate thing, is that we're putting fear in the hearts and minds and bodies of people who are either citizens, children who are citizens, families who are contributing, amazing members of our community. We are harming our own, meaning our own country, our own county, our own town, and our own village. We are doing no good. So the bad guys that need to be caught, they can be caught in ways that involve judicial warrants. Any one of the guys or the women that have been scooped up in some of these random raids that ICE is so excited to say, look, we got a criminal. Every single one of those people thus far has been, if they've had a DWI or whatever it's been, they've gone through the process of our legal system, meaning that they're findable, number one. Number two, our local law enforcement has done its job. They've done their job. That person has served their time. They've done whatever they've had to do for the consequences. Our system is working. But ICE sort of waves the flag, like, look, we got the bad guy. You could have known where they were by simply opening up a quick little database of who's on probation for a DWI. But instead, you do a random raid where you inhibit children from going to school, you scare the heck out of families, you stop up the relatively smooth processes that we have on the East End of Long Island with our great law enforcement. They keep the order, they keep the peace. But now you're breaking all of that to get the guy that you could have found in a second, if you wanted to. So the process is lining up with the original stated goal. We know that. But what we need to do is have reasonable people coming forward to say, hey, I didn't sign up for that. Whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, it doesn't matter. I didn't sign up to shake up our community so that the foundation of public safety is broken. Who wants that?
So what you're doing and with this cooperation, is there any activities that local people who might be otherwise targeted could do that they didn't think they could do?
That would be targeted or not targeted? Like undocumented folks or Latinos, or who do you mean?
I mean, well, anyone.
Anyone. Yeah. I think right now, getting this law passed is extremely important, because what's most important about this law is that it will reconnect some of the fabric between local law enforcement, local government, and Latinos, non-Latinos, parents, elders, people that are worried about what changes in our community when these random ICE actions happen? Because everything changes. There are running red lights, people screaming and running off the side of the road, and there's no need for it because they're not looking for someone with a judicial warrant. They're just out there chasing people down. And if they're doing that in front of a school, which they've done in Riverhead, Riverhead has had some of the worst raids in terms of placement. Southold has had some horrible raids because they went to a laundromat at 9 a.m. on a Sunday. No judicial warrant. Just showed up on a Sunday morning. Scared the heck out of the families. Took some people. One person who we know that we're still working with his two sons, his two 10-year-old sons, doing the laundry at 9 a.m. Thank God his sons were there because they were crying and freaking out. And the agent at that point said, okay, we're not taking you, but show up for a check-in on this date. And so he did, and he's part of a viable pathway, for asylum. But the issue is that people should be showing up to speak out in favor of this law, and not blindly. If they want to learn more about it, they can certainly reach out to Ola. We're putting as much information as we can so they can read through it in English, they could read through it in Spanish, they could understand what it is, because it's being mischaracterized by people that like to put fear out there about things. This is not stopping law enforcement from doing anything. It is actually holding up law enforcement as the very important agents of public safety that we know them to be. It is basically saying, yes, local law enforcement, you have the right to be there. It might not feel great because you can't necessarily stop a bunch of things, but your presence is meaningful to our community, our full community. Old people, white people, young people, rich people, poor people, it doesn't matter. You're doing a great job. So be there in those moments when there is chaos. Why, in the moment of the most chaos, will you not be there? And it has happened that local law enforcement has felt well, I can't do anything. You know, I'm not allowed to stop it. I can't do anything. So my presence there is not going to be something that will make or break the action. And that's not what we see as truth. What we're seeing from people that are coming to us, and these are documented white people and Latino people, African American people, brown skin people that are saying, we want a local law enforcement presence because we do feel safer to know that they could be in that place when that action is happening, at the very least, to just be identifying that, yes, that is an ICE action. And that if it is in a sensitive location, that then the town or the village would have the responsibility of enacting a safety plan that says, hey, how do we get the kids home? How do we get the kids out of the school bus to the school if they're too afraid to get out of the school bus? What happened? So that should be a coordinated response with schools and local law enforcement and the government. And we are looking for those plans to be in place, along with local police having the requirement to show up if an ICE action is happening or perceived ICE action is happening to assess the situation, report and respond back. That's about it. So it couldn't be any more simple, but it's important because it reconnects the fabric of what can we do as a community? What can we do? Not only what can't we do, because everyone throwing their hands up and saying, gosh, I wish I could do something, is a fallacy. And what it's doing is kind of ripping apart at the seams what has been working really well on the East End of Long Island. All of these independent governments and law enforcement agencies, they can work beautifully. But in this moment, when there's such a pressure and a power to pull people apart, it is a critical moment for us to reestablish what is that beautiful thing that we have in every town and every village? How do we keep it together? How do we highlight public safety in that way? And that's why we're doing it.
So, has it been effective in East Hampton where it's already in place?
East Hampton Village, not East Hampton Town yet, but we do hope so. East Hampton Village, I believe so. What has been so encouraging for me has been the unanimous vote that the East Hampton Village Board had with the leadership, I believe, of the mayor. And they made comments, they made statements. So they didn't just vote begrudgingly, you know, they made statements of support because they see that this is only good, this is only positive. So I think what's very encouraging is the fact that local law enforcement is also involved in that decision. Local law enforcement, they report to the police commissioners of every town and every village they work for. And the police commissioners are the town board or the village board, right? So to see that local law enforcement in the East Hampton Village realm certainly provided their input, and the village board voted unanimously to bring this law in. So already you've got cohesion, you know, and that's already a positive step. So right now, there has not been a random raid since that law went into place in East Hampton Village. But simply stating that you now have that law is a critical component of public safety, you know, already.
There is some other th things that Ola is does projects and things that someone can do if they need help.
Sure. I mean, if they need help, if they want to help, I mean, one thing that I'll highlight that's an example of the work that we do that doesn't benefit only Latinos, because I do want to broaden that out a bit. We are a Latino-focused organization. Of course we are, but at the same time, we are living out here. We are homeowners. We are people that have lived experience on the East End of Long Island. And mental health for adolescents over the years, and I'm talking over the last 10 years or so, has been a focal point for us. So what we developed is something called Youth Connect. And Youth Connect is a program that we bring. We don't charge the school, we don't charge the families, we don't charge anybody. And we are on the New York State budget for this as well. It helps support it. It doesn't cover the whole budget for what we do. But I've got a team of six dedicated people only for Youth Connect. And we go into the schools, we talk about mental health, emotional health, and in Spanish and English, depending upon what classroom we might be in. And we also operate a helpline 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m., 7 days a week in English and in Spanish, depending upon what that student might need. And this is mainly for middle school students all the way up through college level. So if they're having a bad day on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock at night, they're worried about a test on Monday morning, and they're not sleeping, they can be texting us and saying, hey, I'm really freaked out about this test. I can't get to bed. We have a lot of those texts, by the way. And then we might walk them through different breathing exercises. We're not trying to do clinical work on a text line, But sometimes students just need to be able to be heard and for someone to be there just to listen. And so we do that. And half of the people texting us are texting us in English. These are kids that we know by what they're texting. They are not Latino. They could be African American, Shinnecock, white, Latino, a lot of money, no money. They're texting us because we're there for them when they need us. And this is something that we will stick with and continue to grow. But it's an example of what we've grown as a result of knowing where the gaps are on the East End of Long Island. And everybody can tell you that there are gaps in mental and emotional health access for youth. Because it's not about being in a classroom and one person identifying that Johnny's having a meltdown. Great. What about the valedictorian that will never let you know that they're having a hard time, but they're dealing with a lot of issues that they're never going to share because they want to be anonymous. They want to be fully confidential. They don't want to get their parents in trouble. They don't want to be stuck with a stigma of mental health issues. Even to get that person started in a conversation about how can they get the kind of help they need, sometimes that has to happen in a way that is more confidential and allowing them to take some of the next steps, giving them the information that they need in the way that they need it. And so that's what we're doing. And that's a great example of OLA stepping up because we see the gap. We're not going to only step up for Latino kids and say, oh, no. We only care about the mental health of Latinos. How horrible would that be? So we are dedicating a budget of a lot of money to make sure that I have six dedicated people for our adolescents up and through college. And that's a great example of it. And we're not going to step back from that. And we're in a couple school districts that have some other things going on, but we're coming at it with love. But out of the 22 school districts, we're in pretty much every one of them except for about two.
How can people help with these things?
If you check out our website, which is OLA of Eastern Long Island.org, it's a big one, you'll get a sense of the different things that we're doing. And there might be different areas that you might want to engage in. It could be that you want to engage in advocacy and maybe this local law and showing up at town and village meetings to speak in favor of it. It may be that you're really excited about the work we do in education and mental health or the work that we do with other levels of advocacy like wage theft. Wage theft numbers have been at their highest. So people being worked and then not paid, which is against the law. Regardless of your status, it's against the law to work someone and then not pay them. Or if you're interested in the cultural work that we do, we've got work that we do in the theater. We're doing something right now at Guildhall, developing a theater piece at Guildhall in a combination of English and Spanish. We have a film festival that we do in September. So there are other ways of engaging with OLA depending upon your levels of interest. So I would say check out the website. And if you have questions also, if you just feel like you want to be better informed in certain things, you don't have to just be in agreement. You could have great concerns about something. We welcome that. I personally welcome that. I would love to have a conversation and learn what your concerns might be and see if there's a way to kind of bridge a gap of understanding or me to understand some other perspectives as well. So I'm open for all of that.
Tell me about how long have you been interested in this project and when did you become executive director?
Yeah, thank you, Dan. I'm not a native of the East End of Long Island, as any native local will point out, but it actually takes several generations. So, there are a lot of us out here that aren't quite locals yet. I don't aspire to pretend to be local. I own a home. I love it out here. I raised a child out here. But I came out in about 2004 or so to the East End of Long Island, and I immediately got involved with OLA as a volunteer in about 2006 because I was witnessing some pretty scary anti-immigrant things that were happening at the Suffolk County level at that time. And I got involved as a volunteer and I did that for a little bit. And then I stepped away and I joined the retreat and I became the retreat's domestic violence shelter director. So I led a 24-hour crisis shelter for mainly women and children for about 6 years at the retreat and kind of understood that my role, my purpose in life is to be an advocate and to be best I can, an advocate and a protector and a supporter, I guess, of people. So the work in domestic violence was very important to me. And then at a certain point, I sort of reached a place where I could do a lot more as a leader. So I rejoined OLA and became the executive director in 2016 in February, which is an important point to make because that was before that election at that time. But I joined, and of course, everything changed in November of 2016. But from that moment on, it's just been very clear how much our community means to the people who live here of all different backgrounds. And I'm so lucky to get to work with so many different people in the arts community, Shinnecock community, white community, arts and culture and theater and painting. And, you know, I'm so excited that the fishermen, the baymen, I mean, I'm thrilled that as much as I can, I get to kind of dive into all that's beautiful and amazing out here. But it works well together when we're recognizing each other and not sort of chopping each other out of the picture. And so our Latino members of our community, because it's one community, make up a sizable part of what works and how we all work together. And so it's important that this work with Ola is happening. And so I love it. And I love that it's grown. When I was in 2016, I was at that point the only paid person for Ola because it had been run amazingly by a very dedicated board, volunteer board, Isabel Sepulveda de Scanlon being one of them, but other people on the board like Tony Hitchcock and other folks. So in 2016, I was the only paid person. And at this moment, we have 20 people working full time for Ola in a variety of departments. We have two immigration lawyers full time. We've got a mental health program. We've got an advocacy program, and we've got an arts program, you know, so there's a lot of education program as well. So it's grown, and it's important for me that it's sustainable. So it's not just about growing bigger, 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 but how do we sustain it? How do we create a workspace where you have people that want to work there and that they don't just get burnt out? You know, we've had four babies born into Ola and the moms come back, you know, because we are wanting to sustain and create a healthy environment to do really difficult work in. This is difficult work. But it's important that we are, you know, doing great work in the East End. So I'm excited about the work we do and the support I get from the board and the community, quite honestly. So thank you for that question.
Is there a homeless component out in the Hamptons?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I got to say, some of the work that I've done with Dan O'Shea, and Dan O'Shea is the executive director of Maureen's Haven, a wonderful organization. They're the organization that during the inclement weather, most especially the cold weather, they send a van around to pick up folks that are without homes that need a warm place to stay for the night and a warm meal. And they create relationships with houses of faith across the entire East End so that different houses of faith host an evening where folks will sleep there and then have a warm meal. I collaborate with Dan on many occasions, not just me, but our advocacy team, when there might be someone who has certain needs and we can work together to solve those needs. I'll give you an example. A woman reached out to, I think to us or to Dan first, I forget, but she was Latina, victim of domestic violence, and was going to be without a home because she was too fearful to stay where she was staying. And so Dan and Maureen's Haven and Ola worked together to create a safe place for her to be for at least, I think, a week and a half, 2 weeks. And we do a lot of things like that together. I'm very happy for that. Yes, there is a homeless component. It's not only Latino, but certainly Latinos are also part of that. We know that folks are living in the woods. We know that folks can't afford to live out here, but they still work out here. So they could be part of a workforce, but still not have a place to live. And that's, you know, extreme when it's in the woods. It seems less extreme when it's not. Also extreme when people are living, you know, jammed up in a space, or they're, you know, living in spaces that are not that safe. We don't want to see that either. But so the homeless component is real, and there's no easy answer for that except for acknowledging it and not sort of demonizing the fact that we've got a demand for labor and no respect whatsoever for any of the people, not just homeless people that might be Latino, but anybody who's struggling to live out here and also provide the labor that our East End demands. It's just important that we deeply acknowledge that. And I'm glad for the, I think it's the 1% affordable housing fund or whatever taxation thing. That's great that I think every single town signed on for that, except for maybe one. I forget which one didn't. But what do we do with that money now? How are we reinvesting that in the community? Because we cannot be in a situation, and this is not me as an Ola person, this is me as a homeowner out here, is that we can't just have that money and then be stopped because of the NIMBY situation, not in my backyard. If we have the money to do certain things to increase affordable housing, workforce housing, whatever you want to call it. Let's make sure we get those things done and we hold ourselves accountable to actually making a difference, even if it's a few units at a time, however we're trying to reach it. But it can't be so easy that we have a bank account that keeps amassing more wealth for affordable housing, but yet no way to get those projects to actually happen. We got to figure that out. Not an easy thing. And thank God it's not the primary thing that I'm handling. That's very hard. But that's part of the homeless component right there.
Thank you for being on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here, Dan. Thank you.